Well, we seem to have had a little boo-boo going on here today, but that's all right. We pull through. That was Monty Alexander, Jamaica's Monty Alexander, with Bob Marley's Jammin', is the kind of music that Dr. Maya Angelou told me that she liked. We had an interesting discussion. We'll talk about that in a minute. That's from his 1999 album, Stir It Up, the music of Bob Marley. And we opened the program today with Dr. Angelou reciting her very iconic and famous Still I Rise. As you know, she died yesterday at the age of 86. Well, I'll share with you a little story. And it's in 1995. I got a call from a major publication had asked me to interview her. And I said, sure, it was a delight. And to do this, I had to suffer, a really major inconvenience. I had to go to her home. And arrangements were made. I was told I would be picked up at the airport, and I was, by a uniformed chauffeur. A pretty long limousine. It turned out to be Dr. Angelou's personal chauffeur, and it was a very long ride from the Raleigh airport to her home in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Got there, and she showed me to my room, which was going to be right next to hers. And immediately, she said, come on in the kitchen and let's have a chat. And she says, well, I'm thinking of cooking. What do you like? I said, well, I don't, anything that you're making, what are you making? She says, I think I'll do some boeuf bourguignon. You think you like that? And I said, sure, that'd be great. And she set about the task of cooking. And it was as if, we had been long, long time friends. I marveled at that. There was not a slight hint at all of formality. She had her head tied up the way Caribbean and African women do, and women in the South. She was very casually dressed. She was very comfortable and at home, and she was laughing up a storm, and it was a fantastic beginning. And I thought, well, at least my plans were to do the interview. I thought I would do it the following day, and I'd be done. And for my purposes, it would be all over, and I could be on my way pretty quickly. But it didn't turn out that way. We had dinner, which was spectacular. She's a very, very good cook. And of course, I really love cooking myself. And we started talking about these foods. And she went all the way back to Ghana when she lived in Ghana, foods from the South. And she was intrigued by the similarity in foods in the Caribbean, where I'm from Trinidad, of course, and we talked about the variations of the same theme and how connected all folks are, really, in one way or the other, by food, and we traded some techniques and so forth. Bottom line, it was a splendid dinner, just she and I, in the kitchen, at the kitchen table, and we had this splendid dinner. And she said, I feel like talking. Let's start the interview now. I said, great. I ran to the room and got my tape recorder, and I came back and set up for the interview. And I started out by asking the first question. I said, do you recall the circumstances or do you recall the moment that you consciously became aware without a shadow of a doubt that you were a woman. No longer a girl, but a woman. And this look came over her face that terrified me. Now we're sitting right across from each other at the table, and she looked at me as if I didn't know what to make of it, except that I felt that I had done something really awful. I had asked her a really horrible question. And then her face began to change. It was a look first, it was a stern kind of look, and it started to soften, and then the face started to crumble. And she let out this, it was a yelp at the table, and buried her face in her hands. I didn't know what to do. I'm so sorry. I don't know. I'm so sorry. She says, oh, no. She just was just crying. She cried and cried and cried, and I couldn't move, and yet I couldn't reach out to her to comfort her. I mean, it was kind of a kind of intimate moment a person is having all by herself and needed no further interference. And I felt very awful because I thought I had done something really, really, really horrible. And yet I didn't know what it was. And she said, Miss Leed, let's pick this up in the morning. And I said, fine. That would be fine. And she retreated to her room, and I to my room. And needless to say, I didn't get a wink's worth of sleep that night. I just was beside myself. I said, no, here I am. Everything was going along so nicely, and it was just a great atmosphere, and she was so jolly. And then me with a stupid question, and, you know, everything goes totally wacko after that. And I don't even know what to do. I don't know how to apologize. I don't know what to apologize for. I don't know what to say. And yet I kept thinking, well, I'll try this angle of apologizing in the morning. I didn't sleep at all. Early in the morning, there came this knock on the door. I could hear, Miss Leed? I said, yes. She says, I'm up. I said, funny, me too. She said, let's go to the kitchen. And I said, okay. So she's in her pajamas, and so am I in mine, and we go to the kitchen. And she said, I really have to tell you something. She said, I have never, ever been asked a question like that in my life. And she said, I don't know where it came from, but it was as if you came here specifically to ask me that question, because it's a question that I had been avoiding all of my life. And when you asked it, it came at me. I didn't expect it. And all of a sudden, all these thoughts came to me, and I didn't know what to do with them. So I'm very sorry, she said, if I upset you. I said, I was sure that I had upset you. I'm very sorry about that. And she said to me, you know what? You have caused me to now write the book that I need to write, that I've been putting off all of my life. And I will call my assistant today, she said, and I will reserve my room. She apparently would go to a local hotel and hold up there and write her books. That was her writing ritual. And she did that day. And at breakfast, she said, "Well, this is why you are here." I said, "Okay." And we proceeded with the interview. I didn't leave that day. She said, "No, you have to stay and let's talk some more." And it turned out to be a 4-day event. And all of our time was spent in the kitchen talking. And she was rambunctious and she was hysterically funny and she danced and she sang and she cooked. And she invited her son over for dinner, and it was great, a wonderful, wonderful time. And I left. Well, I got back to New York, and I wrote the piece, and I sent it to the editor. I faxed it in those days, no email yet, just faxing, so I faxed it. And a couple of days went by, and I got a call, and the editor said, "You have to come to the office to see this." So I went to the office, Midtown Manhattan, and she said, "This is what you sent me, right?" I said, "Yes, that's it." I looked over the work and I said, "Yes, this is it." She said, "Well, I have never seen anything like this in my life." He said, "Now, what are you talking about?" She said, "You didn't see the comment?" I said, "No." She said, "It's right there on the first page. You can't miss it." I said, "Well, all I see is an exclamation point." She said, "That's the comment. I've never seen that in my life." She had sent the piece to Dr. Angela for her review and for her comment. And she sent it back with an exclamation point. No changes whatsoever. And that was like my biggest joy in writing for a very, very long time. But it was quite an interesting 4 days at her home, a wonderful, wonderful cozy home in Wake Forest. So I know that we tend to be very sad when people leave, but we always have to remember that when they have done their work and have done it as well as she did, there's no reason to be sad at all. She fulfilled her mission on this planet and then some. So, Dr. Angelo, thank you so much for that wonderful interaction that of spending 4 days in your kitchen. Well, I want to talk now about this this travesty that passed itself off as journalism last night on NBC. It should stand as an example of a really bad journalism, what not to do. And to think that this the host of the program, Brian Williams, actually gets paid millions of dollars to do this. This is his craft. Oh my gosh. The only saving grace is that there were no surprises for me. In fact, you would recall that yesterday I said it would be an example of the role of the media in aiding and abetting hidden agendas, except the agenda didn't hide too well last night. Here was a media organization signing on hook, line, and sinker to a public relations program by a group of characters who all need to be put under the microscope and whose actions are highly questionable. Certainly, Ed Snowden has taken the time, well, he took command of the interview because Brian Williams didn't ask a relevant question. Nothing for the vast amount of time with this interview, there was no new information shared. There were no enlightening questions asked. There was nothing really different except one or two things. Chief among them is the fact that Snowden admitted, after all this time, when he decided that the word spy didn't fit him, he actually said, well, I was trained as a spy. He takes no he takes no responsibility for actually spying, but he takes he does note that he was trained to do it. Now, these little silly games that the people are playing with, you know, or attempting to play with your mind, I was trained as a spy. Well, did you spy or didn't you? The questions that still need to be asked, and he would not answer. The man who is all about transparency just kept repeating the same stuff we've heard time and again, and it was for most of the hour a long yawn, because you're waiting for something brand new. And it had all the earmarks of, you know, this staged kind of agreed upon parameters of discussion, what will be allowed, what will not be allowed, and it was a shameful role, really, played by Brian Williams, a compliant sycophant rather than a probing reporter about a subject that should matter and that should actually have absolutely no holds barred on it. Although he claimed, of course, well, it occurred in a secret location. Oh, sure. Sure, it was a secret location. Here you are leaving the United States to go to Moscow at this time when the tensions between the U.S. and Moscow are very, very high. And, of course, nobody knows that you're going to Moscow. And, of course, nobody in Moscow knows that you're meeting either. Although Ed Snowden is under 24/7 monitoring, and in fact, they're living practically with the guy to monitor. If he sneezes, they know. And you're going to tell people this. This is a first insult to people's intelligence. And then, secondly, we get the barrage of the must says, no. I am here as a patriot. I am concerned about the constitutional rights. Ed Snowden presented himself as the one American of all Americans more concerned than anybody else about constitutional rights and the overreaching of government and the potential abuses of government. He's more than any other citizen, he is more concerned than anybody else. The narcissism in these individuals is just intolerable. And he speaks with this kind of parsimonious attitude that he's actually at 30, he is wise beyond his years. The only thing he didn't say to Brian Williams was, my grasshopper, do you understand me, little grasshopper? As though he's in a position to lecture the world about morality because he has a greater share of it than anybody else, greater wisdom than anybody else, greater prescience than anybody else, a greater appreciation for the value of the Constitution than anybody else, and gave up absolutely no new information whatsoever. And then Brian Williams compliantly introduces the other seedy characters in this play, Laura Poitras, who is a documentarian of sorts and who is one of the recipients of the purloined material, and the great Glenn Greenwald, whose ego is even bigger, if it's possible, than Edward Snowden's. It's about all these folks being egomaniacal, egotistical, and to them, this is about me. As long as I have the lights on me, look at me. Here I am on the world stage. I'm 30, in the case of Snowden, I'm 30 years old, and I have the United States quivering about what I would do next. And Glenn Greenwald, I have everybody waiting to see what I'm going to do next and what I will unleash next. And they're all talking about stolen material, stolen by a spy. That's what he is. You're looking at a spy who had the nerve to remind people that he did very well as a guy without a high school diploma. Made a very, very good living as a guy without a high school diploma. And I was, trained as a spy by the CIA in this one. And I have operated clandestine operations at the highest level. Who cares about what you do? Answer the question. Who are you working for? How many documents do you have? Why is it okay for you to steal material and hand it to somebody else? We don't know where the material is. Nobody knows where the material is. There are no guarantees that anything you say is true. Why should people believe you? You're a liar. When you're a spy, you're trained as a liar. And we have ready evidence of your long string of lies. You lied to your coworkers to get their passwords. You lied on your application to get in. You lied and misrepresented that you, in fact, had at least a college degree. You lied and lied and lied and lied. That's what you do when you're a spy. You're a liar. Nobody should trust what you say. But, of course, there are hundreds of millions of dollars that have now become a cottage industry for these individuals who have now parlayed stolen classified governmental information into very, very lucrative contracts. They're about now, it is said, to sign a big deal with Sony to make a movie about Ed Snowden. And Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and others are now part of an outfit, a media outfit, funded by Pierre Omidyar, Mr. PayPal, who, with the U.S. government, financed the rebels of the Ukraine to destabilize the government of the Ukraine, who, with his wife, had made as many more visits to the White House in the last 4 years than some of the most powerful people in the United States, sometimes twice a day, unheard of. So they're very close to the U.S. government. You're working for a man who has destabilized a country, and you're a great liberal, and you revere the Constitution. And you revere the rights of people to choose and to know about their governments and all of that. And you are partners and employees and beneficiaries of the largesse of a person who is tied into the security state. No. And here is NBC putting at your disposal. This is how obscene it is. NBC is putting at the disposal of these miscreants, these pathetic examples of journalists, all of its assets to get the story out, to provide the counter narrative so that we will suspect nothing when the deal is announced that Ed Snowden is on his way home. Everybody knows, and I called it every step of the way. I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just reminding you that I have called it exactly as it has unfolded. And we're learning now Ed Snowden is supposedly telling people, oh, yes, I was trained as a spy. I said that word, go. You're a spy. It doesn't take a genius to understand that. Oh, the NSA is spying on people. Well, glad that you found out this late this late in the game, it's good to know that you finally found that out. Considering that you were working in the agency, you were partners with the agency, you were in fact one of the agents of the agency doing all these underhanded things. And all of a sudden you're supposed to accept the fact that you had this incredible pang of conscience. Well, folks, let me break this down for you, okay? This is why these folks are so dangerous. And I know quite a few journalists who present themselves as, you know, the agents of change. But the change that they have and the change that they want has dollar signs on it. This person, Ed Snowden, is known to us because he was two hair breadths away from being snatched and made to disappear someplace because they found out that he was a spy. They were on to him. I said it. And so he had to get the heck out of Dodge, which he did. But the story is, whose spy was he? Who was he working for? What was he doing with the material? Do we believe that Glenn Greenwald is just an innocent blogger who put his hands on something? And how is it that the recipient of stolen material is walking around free as a bird? He acknowledges that he is in possession of classified information. Snowden acknowledges that he gave it to him. But they're all walking around nice and free, which means that there are negotiations going around. There are negotiations going on, for everybody to come out of this with a somewhat clean face. The government has to come out with a narrative that it has pursued Mr. Snowden vigorously. You have John Kerry fulfilling that role, saying he ought to man up and come back and face justice and all of that kind of stuff. They've been talking to each other for a while. Because the fact is, the information so far revealed, in the scheme of things, is really not very harmful. It is alarming to people because, as private citizens, it hits you at a level that you know, it's irritating. But it is not information that essentially speaks to the nuts and bolts of the security state. And that is what they're holding over the government's head. We have the information. You see how we have used other information to get the world on our side. But we have the information. Everybody should see the shift. Here is the great Mr. Snowden, a great constitutionalist, talking about, you know, First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights and whatnot. But the stories shifted away from freedom of speech and protections for whistleblowers. It started veering into foreign countries and what the U.S. is doing in foreign policy and so forth, as if people don't understand what they're saying. They're saying we have information that, if we so choose, could damage the government. Now you've got to give up something. This is a kind of brazen attitude that the Poitras, Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden triad is now basically is a kind of extortion. The U.S. has to look resolute that it will not negotiate on any terms, but it will. It just has to decide how much of this that it can eat, and it has to determine with some degree of conviction that they are being told all that they need to be told by these very highly corrupted people. They don't know. The U.S. doesn't know to this day, it says, how many files were stolen or what it is that they actually know. They don't know who they're working with or working for. So all of these things have to be vetted out before there could be any rapprochement. But in the meantime, they will keep the narrative that Ed Snowden is the champion of the people. Glenn Greenwald is the greatest journalist of all time because he is bringing the news as if he's an investigator. This thing has been put in his lap. Anybody who is reasonably cogent with the English language should be able to formulate a story when this much information is put in your lap. It doesn't require extraordinary talent, and not that he is extraordinarily talented either. You have Pierre Omidyar, who is already hooked into the foreign policy of the United States, partnering with the U.S. and destabilizing other countries. And you have these journalists who have struck a deal to set up this $250 million enterprise, and now they're looking around for movies and books, things that would launch them personally on the world scene so as to make even more money. You know, to charge speakers' fees and so forth. I know a couple of journalists like this. They would swear that they are the epitome, they're the paragons of journalistic virtue. But you lift the scab up and you see the festering sores that they really are. You see all that pus under there. And you have NBC coming to the rescue. Remember I told you the media, nothing happens of this type without the major media getting the okay from the intelligence community. There is no way the Guardian would have printed Greenwald stories, or the New York Times or the Washington Post would print these stories without a phone call to the Defense Department or the State Department or the CIA or whoever it is that needs to clear these things. And they will tell the public, this is good journalism. This is independent journalism. We do not subscribe to the idea of censorship at all. But of course they do. They're partners with, this is how it works. So what do we still need to know about Mr. Snowden? For one thing, we need to know from Mr. Snowden how come he favors transparency for the government but not for himself and his buddies, his partners in crime. What is the relationship between Mr. Snowden and WikiLeaks? Who is he working for? When he thinks because he's such a smart guy and he's getting the advice of a couple of lawyers who say, well, you know, if you transfer what you have to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, you can claim, you know, that phrase from the Nixonian days, plausible deniability. I don't know what's in there. I just turned it over. Well, the question now becomes, how could a person be in possession, publicly admit that they are in possession of classified, stolen classified files, and still be free to walk around? How's that happen? What is the ultimate plan? The ultimate plan, I had theorized, I have no proof of it, but it seems reasonable to me to theorize that you have to look at Snowden as the burgeoning of a new kind of warfare, a new kind of warfare in which we have, you know, just like the pirates of old, everybody is an independent contractor in the game. It's all a nasty game, but it's a lot of money because technology controls information, and the big prize is information. It's all about information and the control thereof. And all over the world, there are people like Snowden who have been planted or who are planting themselves in governments all over the world, making sure that they have their claws into the sensitive information that all governments generate as part of their security operations. All governments have them. Now, whether they are working as a global group or whether they're working as independent contractors, I don't know. But it seems plausible to me that the next level of power is with people like this who control or seek to control that kind of information, because that ultimately is the control, is the ultimate and global power, real power. You can sink a government. You can shut down a government. You can destabilize nations. You can kill entire economies. You can rule the world. It is not accidental that people like Jeff Bezos and Omidyar and others who were in the technology field are very, very serious about consolidating their position in the information, the media and information field. We have Bill Gates, who has been buying up entire libraries. The future will be that information itself will be the industry, a very stylized industry, where everything that you want to know, everything that you think is of value to you or that is relevant in the way of knowledge, will cost you and you will pay for it. There will be no need for libraries because it will be part of the industry. Whatever it is you need to know, be prepared to pay to find the information, because that they are amassing information at incredible rates, staggering rates, and positioning themselves as the controllers of information. Now, what does that do? It gives you the power, as I said before, to do all these things, to control economies, to destabilize nations, to crash nations, to bring down nations, to put up false nations, the ones that you like. You don't actually have to go to war. You have the power to wage war technologically by constricting information, what people know. It is not accidental that a critical element of war making is the PSYOPs units, the psychological operations units. These are units that are dispatched to persuade people who are being attacked that they're being attacked and their countries are being destroyed for their own good. Pacification, acceptance, having you orient yourself and accept completely illogical things, things that are antithetical to your interests, which is a pervasive and global kind of mind control, you see? That's what these folks are into. They are aware of the power of reshaping reality. They know how to make it work. They know how to present it. They know how to energize a community. They know how to get people to think this way or to think that way. And they know how and when to trigger that stimulus so that it in turn triggers a reaction. And it now can be done on a global scale. You don't need armies. These guys could sit in some remote quarter and completely destroy a nation. And that is the awesome reality that the United States actually is dealing with, and much of the world. When you see these jerks like Snowden, like I said, a guy without a high school diploma, sitting down there talking like he is, Socrates, and Herodotus wrapped up in one. That he is the exemplar of knowledge and correctness of behavior. It should terrify people when you listen to this guy talking. It clearly registers that there's something wrong psychologically with him. His notion of his own importance in the world, and that the way he sees the world is the way the world ought to be seen. We have seen many figures come along on the historical plane with exactly that psychological profile. And this world that he is operating in is riddled with them. The three of them that Brian Williams was forced to recognize and to include in this discussion, which was supposed to be about Snowden, they're all of that ilk. It is, the way I see the world is the way the world ought to be. And while they're professing that they're doing these things for the benefit of others, they're not willing to put it up to a vote. This is not about democracy at all. They insist that it is, but it's that kind of democracy that matters. These are some sick, sick, illogical, unstable people. They're liars, and they are ethically, to say they're ethically challenged is being very kind. They have already indicated that they have no standards. They're not to be believed. And you cannot trust that they are the people who are going to be making the right decisions. And they're not entitled to make the right decisions. Who the heck is Ed Snowden that he should make a decision for me about what's important to me? What qualifications does he have to make the decision for anybody? But you see, we come back to this thread in the American fabric of life, or the fabric of American life, called white supremacy. And here we have a natural outgrowth of that kind of thinking. In the same way that the United States thinks it could dominate the world, we have a new generation. It has become all the more offensive about the application of white supremacy, but that's white supremacist thinking. We saw it paraded on NBC. That is a fundamental part of this equation. These folks absolutely are convinced they are qualified and they have the right to disrupt whatever they need to disrupt, destroy whatever they need to destroy in order to get their way, because their way is the right way. Are they qualified? Who the heck are they? Are they even mentally stable? Are they mentally stable? And all parties in this are lying. The government is lying. All of these individuals are lying. The news outlet that calls itself NBC is lying. Everybody is lying. Trust none of them. It's a bazaar of thieves and liars and deceivers. None of them could afford to be absolutely truthful to people, to the people that they supposedly are advocating in behalf of. But I want to draw one very important point here. Bring this to your attention. Ed Snowden as a so-called whistleblower, compare him to Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning, who released all of those files that he stole on the Iraq War, went on trial, was convicted, serving time. Or any other whistleblower that should be respected, did they get paid? And of course, no one said, I have never gotten paid. Well, come on now. Let's stop kidding each other. Is it about personal fame? No. Did they monetize their actions? No. Did they make a ton of money and get into movies and books and all of that for the sake of being famous and to put their names in the history records? No. When you are an ethical person, it shows up immediately. And when you look at these two individuals, Snowden or Manning, you tell me who has more ethics, a greater conscience. I tell you, it ain't Snowden. So trust none of them. They're all lying. They all deserve to be, you need to take them for as far as you could throw them. They're not telling you the truth at all. And most of all, Mr. Snowden, we will learn a lot more about him. But I was right. He's a spy. He admitted it. And that's the first thing. That's the first indication that, all right, he's not as impervious as he thinks. He's not as foolproof as he thinks. I want to thank you for being with me today. Certainly let me know what you're thinking at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Eutrice Lead on Facebook. Coming up next, Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Let me hear from you. Bye-bye.